Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 22nd of October. Storm Babette has battered most of the UK, with the east coast of Scotland taking the biggest hit. I don't know if you've seen the footage, Kev, but it looks like Armageddon up there on the east coast of Scotland. This bizarre-looking, it's almost like a foam coming off the sea, which is probably amalgamation of, you know, the sand and the salt water and that. And there's a few people been filmed sort of out playing in it, which looks a bit dicey for me. But yeah, it certainly looks like the second named storm of the year has hit very much, you know, it's hit very hard up there in Scotland. And there's been a lot of localized flooding as well. So
I haven't really seen very much of it. Been more focused on what's been going on 450 miles from me in Gaza, to be honest. But yeah, and the sun is shining. It's 30 degrees in the Middle East today. It's beautiful. But yeah, it's not good weather-wise, and obviously what's happening in the world is also not good in terms of its potential to escalate, and Hezbollah and Iran getting involved. It's all, I wouldn't say it's a bit scary for us at the minute, but you just never know what's going to happen. It's all a bit of a mess, and it looks like Israel's ain't going to back down. You know, I'm feeling sympathy for the Palestinian people. I suppose the interesting point, I was thinking to myself when I was reading some of the stuff, that there's like two parties to this. You've got the state of Israel and the Jews, and they're not the same. And you've got the Palestinian people and Hamas, and they're not the same. Do you understand what I mean? Yeah. So it's like these are fighting each other, and in the crossfire, it's actually the Jews and the Palestinian people who are getting hurt.
Yeah, of course. So it's always the innocents, isn't it? I mean, they're radicalized on both sides, as you say, aren't they?
Yeah, completely. You know, we do have an Israeli Zionist state, you know, whether we like it or not. You know, it's not, you know, the land of milk and honey that the Jews were promised. This is not what Israel is today.
And I've said it loads of times, and you feel like the security going through the airport there is unbelievable. You know, you have to arrive 4 hours. When you're leaving, it's not getting in, it's getting out of Israel, which is bizarre, because it's like, well, you should be waving goodbye to me and sort of wrapping my sandwiches in a roadmap. Do you know what I mean? But it's genuinely, you go there, they interrogate you for half an hour. Who have you been with? Who have you seen? Has anyone given you anything? Has anyone done anything? It's like the Spanish Inquisition getting out of Israel. And they're just super paranoid that you're taking away, I don't know whether it's state secrets or whether you've been here to, you know, spying on them or something. So super paranoid. But how much of that stems from the way that they have been victimized over the years? You know, look at the genocide that they've been through, not just the Second World War, when, you know, obviously they were persecuted massively at the hands of the Nazis, but also the pogroms of the late 1800s, where there was a mass exodus. You know, people think Israel is actually a new state. Well, it obviously Israel is, but the Jewish have lived in the land of Israel, that area, for 2,000-3,000 years, you know.
Yes, in the land of Palestine, if we're going to be like strictly correct, even in the Bible, it's my people Israel. Yeah, but the land is Palestine, right. You know, Palestine. So, but you know, I don't know whether you ever traveled to Palestine and then come into Israel, because I've been in the West Bank, in Bethlehem, which is where is in the West Bank.
Yeah,
we were visiting friends and stuff in there, and then we had to come through the security gates to get into Israel, which is obviously Bethlehem's not that far from Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And unbelievable security. You just would not believe what you had to go through, like body checks, passports, the whole works, where have you been, what are you doing? The same sort of thing as the airport. But the interesting thing is the Palestinians on the West Bank, who the lucky ones, if you like, who have the permission to work in Israel, have to do that every day, both ways.
Yeah.
Like it's...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Can you imagine going through the rigmarole of that every day? It would be
mind-blowing, absolutely mind-blowing. And the people of Gaza can't really get out.
No.
And have never been able to get out in the last two decades.
It must be living hell for them, for sure. I do sympathize with them, as you say, but yeah, it's a difficult. I mean, we've obviously had Rishi in Israel and now in Saudi for emergency talks. He expressed support for Israel during his visit to Jerusalem, where he met with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Sunak stated that the UK stands in solidarity with Israel and supports its right to self-defense in accordance with international law. He also condemned Hamas as pure evil and praised Israel's efforts to avoid civilian casualties in its response. Sunak's visit followed that of President Joe Biden, US President Joe Biden, as world leaders seek to prevent the conflict from escalating further.
And Biden's visit was a total flop.
Yeah, well, it was overshadowed with the hospital bombing, wasn't it?
Well, it was, but ultimately all the Arab leaders just pulled out. Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, they all just, like, I don't think Syria was involved actually, but they all just said, no, we're not meeting you because of the hospital.
Yeah, so it was
the hospital incident, because I think, you know, I've only weighed up the facts I've been seeing, and I've tried to search a bit more to try and get facts as opposed to, you know, either the Hamas rhetoric or the Israeli rhetoric. But it looks to me like there has been a mess up on the Gaza side, and it's flown into the car park, and you've got a whole load of cars full of petrol.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, did you see his comments? Rishi's comments were interesting. He said, "We will stand with you in solidarity. We will stand with your people." And he even borrowed a phrase from Sir Winston Churchill, saying, "I'm proud to stand here with you in Israel's darkest hour as your friend." So obviously very much comforting words, and Biden pretty much echoed those sentiments. And I think they've promised, or one thing that Biden did push for was humanitarian assistance, which we're obviously seeing on the Rafah border, probably not far from where you are at the moment. And hopefully we're going to start seeing these hundreds of trucks that have been waiting for days now with aid, yeah, you know, with water, with provisions.
They're fixing the road basically because they can't get the trucks over the border.
Yeah.
So right in today, they're fixing the road. I mean, I said today's Friday as we record this, but Friday's the day off here.
Got a question for you on this. I don't want to dwell too much longer on it. So Hamas, we know that they live underground effectively and off radar. Yeah. Gaza's strip is the size of the Isle of Wight, so it's not small. And they reckon there's 300 miles of tunnels underground. Okay. So it's really like another Gaza city underground. Videos posted of them I've seen from Hamas, they're actually making the missiles in these factories, spraying them up black, obviously, so they don't rust if they're on shelves. It looks like they're using like car exhaust silencers. So they're very, very clever with the way that they can make their own weapons and munitions. Can you imagine that the heavy losses that the IDF would face, though, if they went into Gaza? And I think that's one of the reasons why we're not seeing a ground offensive, because they're weighing up. I mean, it's almost like they're fighting against the Viet Cong in Vietnam. The Americans fighting against the Vietnamese, you know, popping out of jungle tunnels, trapdoors. Tanks are never going to fit through the narrow and crowded Gazan streets. And the Israelis don't know the tunnel layouts, you can assume. So do you think that is preventing them? Do they want another Vietnam on their hands?
Yeah, all of the above, really. I mean, there are many issues. And I mean, there is no way that Hamas are going to be like lying down and just letting them come in and do that. All of those are going to be booby trapped.
Yeah,
even if they've
and the longer it goes on, the wait less, the more chance that they're going to be setting more. You know, it's allowing them to regroup. And the other thing is, as you mentioned, I think yesterday, they basically have said Israeli have issued the decree saying, yeah, you need to basically evacuate northern part from up to the Wadi, which is effectively northern Gaza. So what's stopping Hamas from moving in the underground tunnels, we can assume run from north to south, and then just blending in with the normal Palestinian populace?
Well, and no reason. But they also are the normal Palestinian populace. So don't think that they're all walking around with horns on their heads, because they're not. You know, these are normal Palestinian people, and they've had 16 or 17 years. So the young boy who was born 16 or 17 years ago, how do you think he's been indoctrinated over the last 16 or 17 years to now fight the Israelis?
Yeah, no.
And every other child that's been born in this century, basically, yeah, with 50% children. So, I mean, I don't know. I agree with everything you've said in terms of it's going to be a difficult situation. And if Hamas, in inverted commas, get wiped out, I don't think they're going to get wiped out completely. It's not actually the void.
I mean, the rest or the continuing Palestinian generations will just continue to breed contempt and hatred and pass that on to instill it into the children for many, many generations to come. So it's you're never going to eradicate all this, are you?
No. It's no different than happened in Ireland as well. It's no different.
Same thing. All right, let's move on to something a bit closer to home. The Conservatives have suffered a crushing defeat in two by-elections. Labour overturned big Tory majorities in both Mid-Bedfordshire and Tamworth in Staffordshire. If there was a general election this year, Kev, would you reckon? Labour win overwhelmingly? I think it's looking that way.
I think it would be a landslide for Labour if there was an election this year.
Yeah,
I think it has to be by end of 2024, does it? Or is it into 25? I'm not sure.
I think it's it's about a year from now, isn't it?
So, yeah, I mean, they haven't been forgiven, have they? Let's put it that way. The politics, whether we like it or not, tends to be very emotional for people. And any reports I've seen is there's obviously been a huge swing of Conservative voters voting for Labour. Labour looks a bit more reasonable under this man, though, no? You know, and also people are sort of saying, well, can't be much worse than what we've got.
He shot himself in the foot, though, didn't he, recently, Starmer, with his comments about Hamas and Palestine, and basically saying how much he was, you know, looking out for the Israelis. So I think there's a lot of Palestinians or friends of Palestinians who actually handed the letter of resignation in. So he lost quite a lot of the Labour backbenchers as he effectively didn't show support for them. So that was interesting. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that his Labour conference that was up in Liverpool, wasn't it, about just over a week ago now, he delivered a speech. I don't know if you saw it, where he was effectively attacked with glitter. A guy threw lots of glitter on him and he just took his jacket off and carried on. He actually won a lot of plaudits over. You know, there was a lot of people saying it was actually a really, really well-polished speech. And I think he's got a much bigger following now than he's ever had.
Yeah, I mean, what is the choice, I suppose, is the question. What is the choice between Conservative and Labour? Because it's becoming apparent that, you know, the rich are getting richer and richer and richer under the Conservative government. And, you know, Labour is going to try and stem that situation, you know. Yeah, and it needs to happen. Like, the gap cannot be as big as it is in all around the world, not just in England or in America or whatever. Whenever I was in America, the haves and the have-nots are...
There's not a bigger country to see that, is it? US is unbelievable for that, for the haves and have-nots.
You know, and everybody sort of puts up the US as, oh, this is amazing, you know, the land of dreams, the American dream, you can follow it. But there's an American nightmare out there as well, believe you me, much more so than in the European nations and the UK.
Well, that rings on to UK interest rates looking unlikely to rise, say the experts. Likely we may see inflation back to 5% soon after the ONS confirmed it was persistent in September at 6.7%. The recent cost of living crisis has impacted households facing higher food and energy prices, with higher interest rates causing challenges for mortgage holders, tenants and businesses. While pay rises have matched the cost of living for some, uncertainties remain. Job losses have occurred, with over 200,000 jobs lost, and unemployment is expected to rise further. Pay deals have moderated recently, reflecting expectations of declining inflation, although it is expected to remain above the 2% target. Food prices in particular have seen stubborn inflation. So, yeah, it looks like we finally might be getting a handle on the inflation figures. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think we are, but I think it's all a bit of a ruse as well. I think the scenario is that interest rates are going to start falling again within the next 12 months. Is my view. I mean, maybe it won't be for till the end of 2024, but they're going to start falling again because we still need to have economic growth. And let's be honest, we are living in an incredibly indebted society, both the UK, the US, the Europe, and they don't need the cost of borrowing to be 5-7% because they can't afford it, or we can't afford it as a country.
Yeah.
So
the lack of adjustments to income tax thresholds, because obviously that's resulted in a lot more people paying income tax and moving into those higher tax brackets. And then they're not expecting any tax relief until They're talking about 2028.
2028, it's been already put in the books, hasn't it? 2028, it's still going to be 12,500, I think it is, or whatever the actual figure is. It's probably the biggest tax rise in, not history, but certainly in the last few decades, that effectively it doesn't go up at all for 6 years, I think it was. It was put in 2022, wasn't it? So 6 years, we're not going to get any rise to take any further money, either at 20% or 40%. Yeah, it's stealth tax, ultimately, because we're always used to the inflation. And it allows them to balance the budget or balance the books, which, you know, I think is probably a good thing. And nobody cried about it at the time. But as it goes on and on and on, you see a bigger proportion of your salary coming out every month, as well, along with the increase in national insurance as well, both for the employee and employer. Then, yeah, it's they have to get tax from somewhere, don't they? And it seems like Joe Bloggs is the man who's going to pay it, not the super wealthy guy. But that might change a little bit if Labour comes in.
So, should we move on to today's first guest company?
Yeah, I like to buy some of these occasionally if I ever have any money. So let's move on to a nice, big, bright sovereign.
Today we're joined by Sapangai, CCO, and Frank Eager as the new Managing Director and CEO of Sovereign Metals. Welcome, gents.
Thanks, Phil.
Thank you, Phil.
So obviously, Sapang, you're no stranger to this podcast. And obviously, Frank, you're welcome newcomer to the company. Well, actually, you joined, I believe, in 2022, December 22, as General Manager. 20 years experience in the financing, permitting, development and operation of mining projects with a strong focus in Southern Africa, and a chartered accountant to boot. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your background and how it is working for Sovereign Metals, please?
No, thank you. Thank you, Phil. Thank you, Kevin. So I've been around sub-Saharan Africa for the majority of that time, working on several different mining projects in Mozambique, Zambia, DRC, Sierra Leone, places like that, really focusing on feasibility studies, evaluations of new projects, and project development in a sense, trying to get these things off the ground. And more than often, the projects that I've been working on have been a large scale, large capital requirements, you know, in the junior mining space, really, you know, getting a good understanding of the difficulty that junior companies have in getting, you know, these large world-class, I don't like the word world-class, but getting these large tier one projects off the ground with large capital requirements. So I think that's really have, you know, helped me get a good understanding or assist in getting into Sovereign. This is a tier one project with a relatively, not as large as I've seen before, capital requirement, but certainly, you know, one of, and will be one of the largest, you know, operations, certainly in sub-Saharan Africa, if not in the world. You know, just, I guess, traveling around, working around these parts of the world, in African jurisdictions, I think it's given me a lot of experience in terms of how to navigate the difficulties that junior companies like ourselves find in places like this, dealing with the governments, you know, apart from the fact that shareholders always want to see or believe that these companies have huge upsides, but forget sometimes the difficulty in financing, you know, these large, you know, capital amounts with balance sheets that junior companies just don't, you know, normally have. So, yeah, I think, you know, the experience of the last 20 years and being an accountant, I guess, helps. You know, I'm not an engineer or metallurgist, you know, from that background, but more of a, you know, I think the business side and the finance side of these projects, and being able to pick up the technical elements over time, and obviously dealing a lot with the technical teams on feasibility of projects has given me a lot of that element of getting these projects at least permitted and, you know, into the efforts of financing. You know, that's a whole new ballgame.
So Frank, where's those dulcet tones originally from? Where are you from originally?
Oh, from the Karoo in South Africa.
Okay, I was going to say. So there's lots of springboks and lots of animals all around.
There's lots of springboks. There's lots of Karoo bush. And there's lots of heat, but lots of open sky. But yeah, it's a lovely area.
Yeah, indeed. I've driven through it. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So what brought you to Sovereign Metals in the first place? Where, because you obviously joined in 2022. So what attracted you, or they attracted you, or what happened?
So I've been working in just across the border in Mozambique on a steel and vanadium project there for some time. I wasn't really aware of Sovereign Project, and I don't think many people have been and still are aware of the large discovery of rutile and graphite in Malawi. The chairman actually approached me to join in some way or other, and it turned out to be a general manager role in essentially not based permanently in Malawi, but sort of spending half my time, you know, in country. You know, when Julian and Ben explained the fundamentals of the project to me, it attracted me immediately. You know, you guys have seen the pre-feasibility study results. I don't see any reason why this project cannot, you know, ultimately be developed. A few things happened in the last, you know, number of months, including the Rio Tinto investment that's increased the probability of it ultimately being successfully developed. So now I think the fundamentals of this project, you know, certainly attracted me. Malawi itself, I didn't work in Malawi previously, but, you know, listening and doing a little bit of research, it certainly seemed like a more favorable place, more favorable jurisdiction than places like DRC and Mozambique, where I have spent a lot of time in the past. You know, an approach from the company, but ultimately the fundamentals really helped me to make a quick decision on joining.
So your mother tongue is Afrikaans?
Correct, yeah.
So Afrikaans accountant, this means you're going to save money. I know we deal with Afrikaans in Jubilee Metals down in South Africa as well. And yes, they know how to do things well and not on a shoestring, but a tight budget. So I would say everybody should be encouraged by those two things that you represent. But from the point of view of this project, Tell me I'm wrong, but 15% being bought by Rio. Rio don't do investments. Rio buy projects. So the scenario is we are in a situation where right now we've got a PFS. The PFS says all is good. And actually, if these deficits occur, both in graphite and the titanium dioxide, then these figures are going to look like Mickey Mouse figures, because the price of both of those assets are going to skyrocket, you would imagine. So surely this is what Rio Tinto is looking at and setting itself up to say, okay, we would like to buy this company. If that question is not appropriate, then don't answer it. But
you know
what I do.
I don't think Rio Tinto invests in any project, in just any old project. They don't invest in any old country. I think they do their homework, you know, very carefully. You know, from what we've seen or know over the years, is that they really look into things or projects which has got a long life, multi-generational. And this certainly has all those elements. You know, whether they're ultimately going to make a bid or not, you know, we're not sure. But we do know that they are not financial investors. You know, they do have the right as part of the agreement to be the operator. And I don't think, you know, those things would have been in the agreement if they didn't have the intention to ultimately be the operator. The graphite market, the rutile market, you know, I think those are all positive. For me, the one of the most important pieces of this project is the low operating cost and the, you know, the large scale, the longevity of the project. You know, this is going to go through a number of economic cycles over the next 50, 75, 100 years. I think Rio Tinto looks carefully at the operating cost. That's one of the key metrics of a tier one project. It has to be able to sustain any, you know, trough or upside or in the cycle. So that's the key element of this project. So for me, I think Rio certainly looks carefully at that. And the other element is the, you know, the global warming potential. You know, I think it's something which is at the top of everybody's mind at the moment is climate change. This, both graphite and rutile, you know, the global warming potential is lowest, you know, in the sector, you know, these two commodities. And ultimately, the end users want to see, you know, how they can replace high carbon units with low carbon units. Look, I think there is an opportunity or a possibility that Rio will come in at some point. We just don't know. Well, obviously, we can't tell you for sure if or when, but there is certainly a potential or possibility for that.
Yeah, and I mean, if you did have a list of mining a mining project list that ticked the boxes of ESG commodities that are going to be in demand and in deficit, tick a rate, internal rate of return of 28%, and that's based on the current figures and the current prices, and maybe even lower than the current prices, tick. You know, I mean, the reality is, as an accountant, if someone came to you now and said, here's $580 million, which is what you require, okay, do you see that this would be well spent in this project?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is still PFS stage. So there's still a margin for an increase in that number or a reduction in that number as we get into a little bit more detail or accuracy over the course of the next, 2 years, whatever the time frame is that we can complete a definitive study. But yes, I think, the capital to first production, it's in comparison to other large-scale projects and mining projects of this scale, I think the capital efficiency is quite low. Again, if I had to tell other accountants, or we had to sit around, have a very exciting accounting, and as you know, accountants can be very excitable around a dinner table. I think we will agree that the numbers stack up.
Yeah,
and I'm very positive about the PFS results. I think it's been very good.
Yeah, and I mean, you're talking about $16 billion of revenue over that 25-year period. If Rutile, and maybe Sapan can answer this just as well as Frank as well, but you can both answer. If the rutile price increases by, let's say, even 25%, and the graphite price increases by 25%, what are we talking about in terms of internal rate of return increase and also revenue increase from the $16 billion?
Yeah, look, our sensitivities are in the PFS announcement, but what I can tell you on those prices, we had a long-term rutile price in our model of about $1,450 a ton. The current last reported price was close to $1,900 a ton. So big haircut there. In terms of the graphite price, we took our graphite basket to one of the leading commodity price forecasters in the graphite space, Fast Markets, who gave us all the industry analysis required for the PFS. And we said, look, this is our basket. What do you reckon is a price for this graphite basket long term, going into the future and feeding into the lithium ion battery space, etc.? And they came back with a per ton figure of 2,680. In the PFS, we've used 1,290. So a huge haircut comparative to where the leading consultants have placed us. Compared to the peers, in terms of other graphite developers who put out scoping studies, PFS, DFSs over the last 2 years, their average is about 1,600. So we're below the peer average in our pricing forecast. And we've done that on the basis that, as you guys well know, we're a prudent bunch, we're a conservative bunch. We all have seen the forecast of where the market is supposed to go. Do we know that for sure? No. So why don't we see how robust our economics are on a conservative basis now? And if I'm coming out with a $1.6 billion NPV off the back of these, then I'm pretty happy that if the market goes the way it does, it's going to be a lot better.
I mean, even just guesstimating there, you're probably increasing your overall revenue by 50% based on those figures that you talked about. Up to $25 billion instead of $16 billion, and your NPV will probably be more like $2.5 billion as opposed to $1.6 billion, as you said. So, and again, they're just total guesses, so we don't take them as read. But the upside is phenomenal in terms of it's a buzz. I don't think it's going to go forever, as in inflate the prices, but there is definitely good upside. Sorry, Frank.
No, I think the assumptions just demonstrates, the robustness of this project. We're using numbers which are conservative compared to peers and to our peers and to what, some of the experts in the market, deem is or are, or we numbers that we could use as price outlooks. But it just again demonstrates how this project can survive essentially in a very conservative or a low, a down cycle. A down commodity cycle, if that happens. So the fundamentals are really, really strong.
Yeah. It all sounds incredibly encouraging. And having read the letter from the mining authority there in Malawi as well, this is a big deal for them in terms of the whole country and the economics of the country. And I won't use the word leveling up because that's a UK term, but their ability to move things forward in, I think they said, tourism, mining, and agriculture by 2063, even though the first 10 years of that is, I think, to 2033. You know, it's going to make a big impact on the country.
Totally. I mean, I've been dealing, and most of my time in Malawi over the last 10, 11 months has been to some extent to set up, you know, our business in country and growing our staff and our, you know, our expertise in Malawi, making sure that we, and as part of our, you know, our modus operandi is to bring up the, improve on the local skills or transfer skills into Malawi. So a lot of my time has been spent on that, but almost the same amount of time has been spent with, you know, government departments, not just the mines ministry, but lands, environment, finance, justice, you know. This project really is something which they look to, you know, they need to replace their reliance on tobacco as a forex earner. So they really are looking at the mining sector specifically or in general, but to the Kasia Rutile project is something which is going to move the needle essentially for them in terms of, you know, economic growth, secondary economic growth from the project itself, earning some foreign exchange. Tobacco revenues have been declining for the last 10, 15 years. So the support from the government is real. They want to do whatever they can to assist us in, you know, essentially fast-tracking permitting. They've established a government technical committee consisting of delegates or, you know, people that they've seconded from all the key ministries. I met them last week for the first time and essentially presented the PFS results to them. So they are, you know, the government certainly is fully on board and they want to do whatever they can do to help us move this project forward as quickly as possible. So I think it's you know, it's quite refreshing to have that welcoming, to feel that welcome, you know, by a government in a country. And it's not always the case. I think I haven't experienced this in the past in other, you know, neighboring countries in the same way. So it really is a positive experience at this point.
Yeah. So here you are, you know, great PFS just announced in the last sort of month. You've got investment from Rio Tinto up to 15%, which I think is about $40.4 million. Several key technical appointments as the company transitions into project optimization and development. I mean, do you want to just tell us what the listeners and shareholders can expect next as the next phase of project optimization and obviously ultimately the completion of a DFS?
Sure. So I think the optimization of the PFS is a key element here. Rio Tinto and our own, you know, technical team that we've just appointed will spend some time in getting their heads around the PFS. And there's a fair amount of work that needs to be done before one can actually go into a DFS, you know, scoping. There's additional, you know, potential geotech work that needs to be done. Certainly additional metallurgical test work on the graphite, for example, that we need to do in qualification of, you know, of the graphite. We are in the process of ramping up, and you'll know this from a previous RNS, ramping up our capacity in our lab to be able to produce more sample for test work. So I think in the course of the next few months, there'll be certainly a lot of, you know, test work at laboratory or lab test work to be done on the graphite and also on the rutile. So we're working on that whilst technical committee with Rio Tinto is being established. The guys get their heads around the PFS and we identify areas where it can be optimized and then scoped to start or to kickstart a DFS somewhere in the next 6 to 9 months, I assume, would probably be a good place to start. But those are the key areas of focus for us in a very short space of time. It's getting everybody up to speed, all the new appointees up to speed, Rio up to speed, doing the long lead items to be able to scope the definitive study. And there will be some drilling work, certainly some sample collection in the field, you know, be able to get our lab going through and processing some samples for additional test work.
So, Frank, the question on shareholders' lips and the question on future investors' lips is, when are you going to have to raise money to do all of this work?
Kevin, I don't think we don't need any new money in the short term. I think the Rio Tinto investment has given us sufficient runway to complete all of this work. We're hopeful that that will be sufficient to complete the DFS in due time. And I think, ultimately, that's why they made the investment, is to take it to the next level of definition. So I don't expect us to be coming back to the market for purposes of this study anytime soon.
Okay, good. So dilution should be out of the equation for the next while anyway, until this becomes a DFS. And ultimately, all the other projects that were in Sovereign are no longer in Sovereign Metals. So there is no distraction here, is there? I mean, basically, we've got one project in Sovereign Metals, and it's this one.
That's the focus. We spun out the graphite assets to NGX. So the focus of the management team, the incoming team, the people that we're building up in terms of our social community, environment, the focus is purely on the Cassia, getting this over the line. Yeah.
Okay, very good. To sum it up, you need to, as an investor, look at the PFS for sure. Next week, we're going to go through that presentation with Sapon on YouTube. So you guys can look at the actual details of it, but it is available there if you want to look at it yourselves. I think the economics look extremely good, and the country needs to do it. And Rio, I don't think, would have invested if they didn't think this was a profitable and also mining project that is going to be for probably millennia. It's going to be for a long time. This project is going to last 100 years, probably. And, are we still going to need all of these things over the next 100 years? I think so, if this is the way the world's going in terms of electrification and also all the different uses of titanium dioxide. So, yes, it all looks very interesting.
Yeah, we'll put a link to that presentation in the description of this podcast as well, so any listeners and shareholders can access the presentation as mentioned.
Yeah, one last question, Frank. Actually, I'm lying. It's probably two or three questions, but one last question before we finish on the Sunday roast. The first one is, what is your Sunday roast? What would be a Sunday roast in the at home in South Africa?
It's always a leg of lamb, Devin. It always has to be a leg of lamb. It has to be. And coming, it's got to be a certified leg of lamb from the Karoo. That is the number one roast for sure.
I would suggest you killed it the day before, no, and then and then hung it out. Okay, and the question that we're asking this particular season is, what is the best piece of advice anybody's ever given you?
The best piece of advice is to work hard at what you're doing right now, not to worry about what's going to come next. That's probably as simple as it can be.
Focus in the present, yes. Very good. Sapon, that question is now at you. You've never answered it before.
Less haste, more speed.
Okay, less haste, more speed. Okay, very good. And the final question from England, South Africa, in the Rugby World Cup, what's going to happen?
I think it's relatively easy answer.
We're going to lose, aren't we? That's what you're saying.
I don't think the English has got what it's going to require. Yeah, I think it's going to be the Springboks.
Yeah, I was hoping the French were going to beat you because we had more chance against the French than we did against you. But you never know. You never know. Eh? When is the match, actually? Is it going to be...
It's on Saturday night at... It will be, 8 o'clock UK time?
Okay, so you'll either look incredibly clever at this point or incredibly stupid if England beat you.
Yes.
Very good. Okay, it's been a pleasure speaking to you both. And, let's hope we get some movement.
So on that note, we'll say Sapon Guy and Frank Eger of Sovereign Metals, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, guys.
So moving on to our next guest this week. So we're delighted to be joined by Robin Brundle, Executive Chairman of Technology Minerals. Welcome back, Robin. How's life treating you?
I'm pretty chipper, thank you, and good to speak to you again.
Good, yeah. Of course, we've just seen the news that Recyclers has received final clearance from the Environment Agency to commence full automated operations at the lead acid battery recycling plant in Tipton. This permit marks a crucial milestone, allowing the gradual scaling up of processing volumes and paving the way for the construction of 8 additional plants in the future. The Tipton plant, the first of 5 planned in the UK, aims to recycle up to 15,000 tonnes of lead acid materials in its initial year, with a goal of processing a cumulative total of 80,000 tonnes across all plants in the coming years. The day's finally come, Robin. You must be over the moon.
Absolutely. Yes, we are. It's been a long time coming. And I know that your listeners will have been on this journey with us. And thank you all very much for those that have invested, for your patience and tolerance with this. It's not been for the faint-hearted, that's for sure. But this news really now transitions us into being an active business across all of the 3 businesses that we have underneath Recyclers Group banner. So we are delighted with that. And to your point about the rollout, yes, it does enable us now to do the cookie cutter on each of the businesses so that we can, you know, escalate the rollout now. We've lost time from the original business plan. And as you know, that's something you can't get back. But what we will now be doing is looking to see if we can find ways to accelerate that rollout. So try and bring the 5-year strategy forwards. And we've got a lot of good work going on that basis. But just to put the numbers right slightly there, Phil, is that the narrative that we applied for the license was 16,000 tonnes, as you know, and the EA have come back and granted 15,000 tonnes. And so if you extrapolate that up over the 5 plants that we intend to have, that will give us a total capacity of around 75,000 tonnes rather than the 80 that you will have picked up at the head of the opening. So for us, that's super. We've been prudent in the business plan. For those that are interested in numbers, you know, we had in our business plan, we had assumed that we would perhaps only be getting around 12,000. So we went on the cautious side in the business plan, but now we've got 15,000. So once we're up and running, and there will be, you know, a commissioning phase, and we'll perhaps talk about that in a second. But once we're up and running with that lead plant and up to that 15,000 tonnes per annum throughput rate, we will have an upside to the business plan once we've hit that throughput.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, we've Kev and I have been up to the plant there at Tipton and obviously seen it's a very impressive facility. And you just alluded to there's going to be a commissioning phase. So do you just want to talk listeners through what that would normally consist of and what you're expecting to find from that?
Yeah, sure. So with a commissioning phase, you know, we have up until now, we've been pre-revenue, as you know. And so it's our responsibility as leadership to make sure that we hold just enough capability to evidence to the environmental agency that we are worthy of the permit. But of course, as business people, we have to keep the overheads as low as we possibly can. So, you know, to keep costs down and burn rate down, of course. So now we're in a position where we've got the permit, but we really didn't know when it was exactly going to come. And so now we're in a position where we've got to switch on working with partners that have shown a lot of interest over the last 2 years as we've been courting them. We've got to now move to contract with them. And for people with the offtake, for example, you know, they will run 3 months hence in loading their lead requirements. So we now need to work with them. So it could be 4 months, for example, before they can actually take our lead that we're going to, or lead paste that we're going to be producing. And so all of these discussions will now get triggered and have been triggered to re-energize. And of course, we do need to increase headcount as well to get into full production mode as well. So technically what I've said in my RNS release and to others is that, you know, we need at least 4 months here. We bought the plant, a proven plant from Brazil. We need to bring over the manufacturer of the plant to make sure that we optimize it. The moment their earliest availability is middle of January, for example. So we've got work to do. And I don't want to take away any of the joy that we've, if you like, de-risked the business by getting this permit. And it's the last of our key permits. There are daily operational permits that we will continue to go through because we're moving hazardous wastes in and out for clients and for off-takers and so on and so forth. So there's always a whole bunch of admin around hazardous wastes, but they are genuinely daily operational activities. But when it comes to the headline permits of being able to function as a business, we now have what we need to be able to do that. So it is a joyous moment, but, you know, it isn't a flick of a switch to suddenly get this business running. And we're going to pedal as hard and as fast as we can to get all of these things in place. But don't hit us too hard on social media if it takes us 4 to 6 months to come back to you and say, we've got that throughput at 15,000 tons per annum.
So, Robin, it's great news. I remember standing, freezing in the factory place. I think it was last November we visited you. I think if I remember rightly. So,
indeed,
not quite a year, but not far off it. But just for listeners, and I suppose for me, what size of market are we talking about here? So, you're talking about if you have five places, you need 75,000 tons of these lead batteries. What size in the UK is this market? How many tons in total?
During that period, Phil, that will represent, only believe it or not, around about 10 to 12% of the market opportunity. Because lead acid batteries spread across a whole range of verticals, from handhelds to power tools to, you know, trucks at airports and heavy goods as well. So it's a very long, 100-odd-year-old established industry. We're not a disruptor in the sense of trying to create something here. We're just joining in and helping to save a material going to landfill, saving it going into incineration. So we're joining a group of people. We're not a disruptor, as I said. And so it's a well-trodden path. And it's a far more simple business plan as well, in that, you know, we have to pay for feedstock at a certain price of LME, and we then sell the offtake at a different value of LME with a margin in between. And whilst those prices might meander through the year as commodity prices vary, the margin will meander. The input and outputs will meander at the same point, giving a reasonably constant margin as we go through. So a far, far more simple business plan.
So we're talking about margins of, I think, if I remember rightly from previous conversations, they were about sort of 30% or something like this.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to go too deep into that, because there'll be people we're trying to buy from that might be listening. So it might be commercially sensitive, but it's dreadfully low, Kevin, dreadfully low. So, you know, we do need to work with our suppliers to get the prices down further. You know, no, I'm just jesting, of course.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay. Anyway, so this really is, I mean, do you feel that getting 10% of the market will be an issue, or you feel, no, it will just come to us?
Yeah, I'd like every business, we've got to work at it, of course. But what we are finding is that because we've got the lithium ion opportunity from the Wolverhampton site, that there are many, many players in the UK, let's call them suppliers and customers, who will who have got both and currently don't have the solution for the lithium ion. So the discussions that we're having are that, well, we can help you with your lithium ion, but so long as we're competitive in the marketplace, we would also like to take your lead acid as well. So those types of, many of those discussions are going on. And of course, we're leveraging our assets there.
Yeah. So it's a nice bribe, basically. We'll sort your lithium ion problem out. So, by the way, we want your lead acid. Okay.
Something sounds good. Something sounds good.
Okay, so moving on to the lithium, so give us the background of that and where we stand today.
Yeah, sure. Overall, we're delighted with the way the plant is functioning and the site is functioning. The biggest key for us was transitioning a couple of weeks back from nitrogen gas bottles. You may remember from your visit that we were using packs of gas bottles of nitrogen, and we've finally, after a 26-week lead time, our tanks arrived and have been installed and commissioned for liquid nitrogen. So we now buy our nitrogen in 30 tons of liquid. And what does that do? It enables us to run continuous running effectively. So it gives us the pressures that we need in the various chambers. It's consistent in the chamber. And of course, we don't have downtime having to stop and change bottle banks and so on every so many hours. So for us, it was the last piece of the jigsaw to do the constant running. And it's great. You know, this week when we've sort of started some days to try and hit those targets, you know, we have been processing the 25 tons that we were targeting in the day this week. So we are finally up and running to where we want to be with that. We've had approaching 100 tons of additional feedstock arrive this week that's attracted a gate fee. So we are finally gone from pre-revenue to revenue this week. So that's a, a very joyous place to be as well. And we've got a whole range of gate fees that we're out there quoting for. So depending on chemistries, we're anywhere from £2.60 a kilo or £2,600 a ton through to a particularly challenging chemistry where our declared price list is £8.60. And we have the opportunity in some instances where we're being offered where others have had fires, you know, burnt material we've evidenced as a result of the fire material that we had on our own site back in July. We've evidenced that we can actually process fire damaged material as well and still recover a whole range of value streams from that material. But again, that does require certain extra workload for us. So we are pushing those prices for fire damaged materials beyond even the £8.60 a kilo. So gate fee for us is starting to come in, which is good. We've got a whole range of verticals. We've got 18 verticals of revenue opportunity coming at us. And we didn't realize we had that many when we started, to be frank. We thought we had about 12. So we've had 6 new revenue streams come at us since July when we declared that we were able to process. So yeah, it's a very exciting space to be in. It's incredibly fast moving, and we've also been invited to participate in a House of Commons select committee around the battery strategy and policy, and that includes minerals as well, and also to go and advise this week the House of Lords to bring them up to speed as to what's required with legislation and to try and keep abreast of the rapid changes that are happening. And yeah, there's been several things that have come at us again this week. So for example, Warwick University have advised government that they believe that it's better to actually recycle EV batteries now because the material that we used in the process to make 4 or 5 year old batteries is enough now with improved manufacturing processes to actually build 5 new lithium ion batteries. So there's a big push to not do second life. The insurance industry has its opinion too on do not fix because of the risk to the older car where it's out of manufacturer's warranty. So it's important to listen to all of these organizations around where our opportunities may come from. And as you can imagine, we're very active in all of those spaces.
So for the foreseeable future, we can see that the cars will be, if they're faulty in any way, then that they're just going to be recycled.
Let's be clear. I think that we're talking about cars that are outside of manufacturer's warranty. So I think where you have a car inside warranty and a qualified certified engineer does a repair or replacement cell, for example, and that manufacturer is then happy with its tests to carry on with that battery under its own warranty, I don't think there will be issue. I think this is the aftermarket here because there was some forecast of having a super aftermarket of people buying secondhand packs out of 5, 6, 7 year old cars that are perhaps out of warranty and so on.
And possibly, as you said, one where insurance companies will invalidate warrant. They'll just say you have to have, you know, properly recycled batteries, OEM spec batteries, basically.
That's certainly, it will be their decision on how they handle that, of course. And there is a salvage, UK salvage policy as well that will help to influence that. So yeah, all of this is happening around us. And thankfully at the moment, it's all heading in our direction, which as a long-term businessman in tech spaces, it's very unusual to, you know, have stuff coming at you in this sort of volume. It's a great place to be.
So do you think that using you're leveraging your background in, obviously, you know, that with the motor industry or the automotive industry, that your relationships that you forge, you're helping the company going forward?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, it's not all about me either. You know, my strength is to engage people who can help us do all of that. So it's about having a little black book of people that actually come on board, and they also have the relationships as well. And any business is not about one person. It's about a whole team of people from every level of the business that you want to talk about. And it's up to us to make sure that we have that team in place. And that's one of my roles as chairman, is to make sure that we work with an effective board and an infrastructure of business that sits underneath it. And we're pushing hard in all of those areas too.
So Robin, recyclist and tech minerals has been a money money-eating monster for the last 2 years. So tell me, are we at the point where we are cash flow positive with these monies that are coming in from the gate fees?
A money-eating monster is not quite what I had in mind there, Kevin, if I'm honest. We've worked so hard to keep overheads to an absolute...
It's the opposite of a cash cow, then.
Yes.
It's a money-eating monster.
Yes, we have been pre-revenue, and yes, as with all pre-revenue businesses, we've had a burn rate, and we've desperately tried to keep that burn rate as low as we possibly can. And to the point I think you were going to, which is from November, we believe that we will be cash positive, yes. So, and primarily from gate fees, Wolverhampton. Obviously, we will still have burn through Halo, but we believe that the volume of business through Wolverhampton will make the group overall be cash positive.
That's great news. That's obviously what everybody's looking for. And the scenario then in terms of what's happening with the black mass, give us an idea of where we're moving to in terms of black mass. I presume through this commissioning stage, we haven't exactly created huge tonnage of this black mass anyway so far.
No, but it's coming because, as I said, you know, when you start producing 25 tons, processing 25 tons a day, then it's here and it's in barrels with us at the current time. So we have been working on, over a number of months, a competitive strategy on this where we've introduced competitive tension, because what's actually happened is that the best value for our black mass appears to be going back to either South Korea or Japan. And the reason it's going there is that they're able at the moment to get all four of the metals or all four of the salts in the black mass and separate them effectively. Now, at the moment, South Korea is getting about 60% of the lithium, but by December, they will be up to 80%. So effectively, commercially, they're able to pay us for all four salts in the black mass that we sell them. However, Europe and the USA are desperate for black mass, but at the moment, their processes, the hydromet processes, are washing away the lithium at the front end. They will have a fix for that, I believe, during the next 12-month period. And so the competitive tension that we've brought into play here is to say, well, look, you know, it's up to you, Europe and USA. If you really want to have this volume of black mass that we're creating, you should pay us as if you are getting four to create the competitive tension. And we've got some traction with that. We have put in our first, to make sure that we've got an outlet, we have put in our application for a transfrontier shipment to be able to go to one particular off-taker until we've got this competitive bidding situation fully contracted down. We expect to have that fully contracted before the end of this quarter.
Okay, very good. So moving on, because a lot of the questions that people are asking is, where are all the lithium ion batteries going to come from? Now, we had a discussion beforehand and you were giving us lots of examples, but what is the situation with the grant and sort of the almost lorry or bus or, you know, disposable unit that was being created? Where are we at with that?
Okay, all good questions. So I'll just break that down. So first of all, our 18 verticals of opportunity with properly researched sectors and using government information. In the UK this year, 2023, there will be 85,000 tons of lithium ion material in the marketplace available to us. We are planning in the 12-month period from startup to process 8,300 on a single shift through the plant. So we're looking at only 10% of that. And you have to also remember that there's been a lot of pent-up demand. So a lot of the material that that's arrived with us this week has been packed in early 2021. So it's been sitting in storage since then. And this type of material is being offered to us from all sorts of places, and in some chemistries, even from Europe. Because you may remember that the UK has decided to be a trading nation. And therefore, whilst batteries in Europe are considered as hazardous waste, the minute they touch the shores here, we classify them as non-hazardous, effectively. They're green waste. So we're welcoming in other people's waste. So we're not relying on Europe at all. That 85,000 tons is coming from all that's here in the UK. So we're only looking for just less than a 10% market share this year. And we are solving problems for people with stored up and pent up problems. So I think that hopefully answers your first question as to where is this stuff coming from. and that's the opportunity. And I think the second question on the mobile unit is that if you track any of the government committees and so on that meet, and select committees and House of Lords committees and so on, you'll see that there is an international push for greater producer responsibility. So let me simplify that in my way, is to say, when I first had a mobile phone, the battery was detachable and I could do something else with that battery. These days they're glued in and they're very difficult to get out. So you end up having to process a whole phone in that scenario to be able to get anywhere near the battery materials. So globally, there's a push in that instance or that example to say, make that battery available again to be detached. Same with the laptop and so on. And so there's a big push from global governments for the net zero challenge to get greater producer responsibility. But the consumer here in the UK is also not increasing responsibility, probably through lack of knowledge on recycling. And so we predict that during next year, there will be legislation that will enable producer cash where they have to pay into compliance schemes. We believe that some of that money will be there to fund a fourth bin collection. So many councils around the UK, I think nearly half of them now, have trialled a lithium ion battery or battery collection system on top of a green bin collection. So there's been trials that have already done. And if you look back in the history of DEFRA, you'll find that if those types of trials have gone on, they generally move to another colour of bin for collection. Now, this is where our lorry fits in beautifully because, whilst we've got some red tape to go through with it and we're working with DEFRA and keeping the environmental agency informed, is that our lorry will actually be able to go and safely pick up like your dustbin lorry does today. But instead of seeing bin lorry fires, our device will shred and process there and then. So it will make safe those lithium ion batteries at the point of collection to reduce harm to humans and harm to the environment. So we're very excited about it, and already word has spread on an international basis. And we've had delegations from other countries that have come over to talk to us about the opportunity that we'll be creating here. What we haven't got yet is the full business plan for that, in the sense of, do we want to be a lorry producer? It's not in our remit right now. So who will we work with? How will we work with them? Is that a joint venture? All these questions, we're having all these discussions internally right now to say, when this lorry is built in 12, 18 months' time, where do we want to take it and how do we want to take it? So I can't give you answers to that, but it's an exciting space to be.
But really, it could be that it's legislated that every council in the United Kingdom is going to have one of these lorries.
We wanted to go further than that, Kevin, in that because they already probably, most councils have the ability to sort hazardous waste. And so already, if the lorry was built today, it could travel to those sites and actually process the batteries at those, what you call as your local tip or your local waste center. So we already can do that. What we actually want is to have a variation or an exemption that would enable us to do the processing on the roadside outside your driveway. Because right now, the way the legislation is written, every household would have to be nominated as a haz waste site, and that's clearly not practical. So we're pushing with the lorry and working with the various departments to say, look, if this fourth bin collection is coming, then here is the solution, and everybody's on board with that. That's partly why I believe we won the $2 million Innovate UK grant for the lorry. And, we believe it will be right place, right time when the legislation comes out in, we think, during the end of next year.
And based on all of this collections and effectively the fact that people are starting to wake up to the fact that these lithium-ion batteries are sort of not toys, which is a bit scary considering they're in a lot of toys. What is the situation with the Halo boxes?
Yeah, so Halo boxes, again, we've got first automotive order for those coming through imminently, and we are using them ourselves, and obviously Slicker as well, one of our national business partners for collection. So yeah, we're pleased with them. And we now are ready, now that we can actually bring the material to our site, we're able to now accelerate the rollout of that product as well.
Okay, so this is sort of the dream situation that you hoped was going to happen probably 2 years ago that you are now in. So how do we catch up those 2 years, if you like, that have been, I suppose in a way it's been treading through mud and treading through water to go to get all of the compliance and the risks happy in the government's mind and in all of the stakeholders' minds. So how do you envisage that Recyclist will move this forward?
So as I said to you earlier on, we would now like to, and we are working on plans internally to get our five-year strategy to actually try and get it down to a three-year rollout rather than a five-year rollout. And there are a number of things that we can do with sequencing the manufacturing of the new plants, for example. And once we have cash enough to do that, you know, we can build a new lithium ion plant, for example, within about 6 months. And if we're able to get the production process going, we believe that we then can get a new plant off about every 6 to 8 weeks after that. So that's one of the ways we're going to do it, is to make sure we've got plants. We've also been talking with, for example, other countries in the UK who we've given access to the data room that we used for the environmental agency to say, please, you know, look at all of this information that we've got, reference permitting. And we know that we're welcome in, into other areas of the UK other than England with what we're doing. So with our cookie cutter process, with the ability to manufacture the plants and then get sequential production going, along with a welcome from areas now that they can see that it does what it does on the tin, we can measure emissions so that we understand, you know, the safety for humans, the safety for the environment. We understand the byproducts and they can see, and it's all tangible now rather than scientific and theoretical. And so now we've got all of that, you know, we're working with the agencies, they're bringing people to our premises to do training. And so, you know, we have a super relationship with all of the agencies, which is what we set out to do. You know, and even with our fire, for example, you know, with the agencies have been extremely complimentary, because as you would expect from a business, we didn't just say, well, let's mop that up. We actually sat down and said, what lessons have we got to be learned from this? And what can we do better? And we've improved our fire prevention plan, for example, and which was signed off initially, of course, by all of the experts. But there's more we could do. So we are now doing that. And we're setting a standard. We're setting the standard for the UK and possibly for other countries around the world here with what we're doing, because it's all new on the lithium ion space. So, yeah. So hopefully that's given you a flavor of what's going on. If you ask me, you know, which site have we selected to be plant to? It's a difficult one for us, because, you know, we have got the five plants in the business plan. But if we're allowed to go to three shifts, we may not need five, for example. So, you know, in our business plan, we've assumed a worst case scenario that, you know, we will do 8,300 from each of the five sites. Well, if we are very quickly allowed to go to the full 22,000 tons with having a second and third shift with our permits, we may only need a north, a Midlands and a south three plants, which will then save us capex as well to get to the same volumes of throughput. So a lot of detail here. I hope it's coming across in the right way with you guys. And, you know, that's just business fluidity. We're still planning for five. We're still planning on 8,300 a shift. But if we can do it with three or four, we will save the capex accordingly, which is just a normal business decision.
Yeah, that was the thing that was ruminating in my head, is that you said there's 85,000 tons, I think it is, of lithium ion batteries available this year. How is that going to grow over the next sort of 3 to 5 to 10 years? I mean, what is the estimates? Because obviously we it's a guess,
but yes,
what is the estimate that we think is going to be available?
I will probably simplify the answer to you to say that our throughput and capacity is unlikely to ever need any more than 10% market share. And the growth is incredible. The growth is incredible.
Yeah, there's going to be a time where we're talking about a million tons of this a year, I'm sure, and more.
Indeed.
You know, so the five plants you're running at 22,000 each a year is 110,000, which today doesn't make sense, obviously. But 5 years from now, it probably does.
Yeah, so just do your maths. Originally, the business plan was 8,300 each for 5 plants. So if you look at it that way, that's where your 10%, less than 10% market share will come.
Mm. Okay, very good.
All right, yeah, on that note, obviously, we'll say thank you, Robin. But before you go, obviously, normally we do the Sunday roast theme, but we've kind of changed it up a bit this season. We're going to ask you, what's the best advice you've ever received or heard?
When the wine is in, the wit is out.
Like it. Like it. Yes.
Indeed. Maybe the wit is the humor comes in, but not the intelligence.
Yeah, I think that's probably
I should leave you to pontificate on that problem.
And the next question is, what is the worst piece of advice you've ever received?
Worst piece of advice I've ever received? Probably try a cigarette.
Indeed. The path down. I think, yeah.
We've had a few say things like, don't buy Bitcoin in its heyday. Turned out. But on that note, we'll say Robin Brundle, Executive Chairman of Tech Minerals, thanks very much for your time.
Nice to see you again. Bye for now.
Yeah, and we look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.
Lovely. Thanks, guys. Appreciate what you're doing. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So let's move on to the movers and shakers this week. We've had the best mover from a 5-day perspective, or for the last week, was Quantum Blockchain. It moved 85%. There's not been any real news of late that I can see, so I really can't add any specific reason for the move. I'd like every stock that we believe in to move like that as a re-rate for stock.
Sure.
Honest, Kev.
I think the news for Quantum Blockchain was that BlackRock are entering into this ETF for Bitcoin, and everybody's basically speculating that if this comes off, that the Bitcoin should rise to between 42,000 and 56,000. So I think it's just in a...
So it's just moving on the back of Bitcoin rather than their actual processing abilities.
I think so, yeah.
Makes sense.
I mean, I think there was an announcement this week for Narwhal, who are obviously not on the market yet, but we're following them, and that was basically saying that they're going to be raising money at a valuation of £60 million now from an initial, I think, 20, 25 million. So they're making a lot of progress with the ability to then raise at 100 million within the 6 to 9 months. Okay, we've got something lined up interview-wise with Mass next week. So let's see what happens. And the other thing was...
The other thing was
Jubilee Metals.
Jubilee Metals announced the award of a significant new slag project with Mopani Copper Mines. Basically, the exclusive award of the slag project aims to process approximately 13 million tons of historical slag estimated to contain 0.7% copper and 0.27% cobalt. So that one looks very interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, and again, I spoke to Leon this week, and next week we're supposed to be having some time with him, an interview with him, and hopefully... It hasn't been finalized yet, but that we will go to Zambia again in early December to look at Jubilee's projects and also Galileo's and Extract.
So the other one I saw was a really good tweet from Oliver Friesen, CEO of Golden Metals. He's been in Tokyo this week, and I'll just read his tweet, actually, because I thought it was very good. Basically, he said that... Well, that's a wrap. Probably the best mining-related conference I have ever been to, as probably 95% of the major players in the tungsten industry from across the globe are all in one place. Excited to get back to the UK and push forward many of the amazing conversations we have had over the last 3 days. I have pages full of notes that I took during the various meetings, talks, and presentations, so we'll share what I can over Twitter in the coming week. So... Very, very, very good. That obviously based at a big convention over in Tokyo, place where I used to live. And also they had some news out in the week on the copper project as well, didn't they? For the porphyries, etc. The copper mineralization at Garfield project. So that was great to see.
Yeah, it's fighting on three fronts now, that gold metal. You've got gold, you've got the tungsten, obviously, and now the copper as well. So the story's getting wider and bigger and better. I spoke briefly on WhatsApp with Oliver there, I mean, before he traveled back from Tokyo. So we're going to try and do something with him next week, so people can have an overview of what happened in Tokyo, because we've been very excited by it. And there was some news out as well on Friday that he tweeted, I think, about basically that countries keeping things inside themselves. So in other words, any of the graphite projects were having to keep stuff inside their borders, I think it was. I don't know the full details, so kind of look up the tweet.
Yeah, he was talking about the resource war, wasn't he? He said China will require export permits for some graphite products to protect national security. Resource war's kicking into high gear, and that was quoted the Gold Telegraph, I believe, in that tweet. So
the other things practically that happened this week was that we saw a big rally in gold over the last 2 weeks, and at a time when the US dollar is as high valued as it's probably ever been in the last, I don't know how, what time frame is, but certainly the last 10 years, I think. So you're looking at a gold price in sterling and a gold price maybe in Australian dollars and a gold price in euros, which is much higher than it has been, almost probably a record. But as it hasn't been a record in US dollar terms yet, nobody's shouting about it, but, you know, gold is flying, basically.
Gold flying, and a lot of people going into the safe haven, especially with the geopolitical issues in the Middle East, pushing up prices, no doubt, as well. So the other one that I looked at this week, well, not really looked at, but it's the whole market from a market perspective, is the FTSE 250 actually dropped to a one-year low, and the FTSE 100 dipping below the sort of 7,500 mark of late. So that was an interesting one.
Yeah, I think we're at a time where there is, you know, you look at something like Teck Minerals Recyclist, effectively, you know, it's worth £22 million or whatever. That's what the market is saying. And Recyclist alone has been valued at $70 million, and that was before we've now got the two licenses and all the things that you just heard Robin talk about. So it's got to be worth north of £100 million, you'd imagine, which even half of that for TM1 has got to be in the region of £50 million, plus any of the mining assets. If you wanna add them together, you're talking about £60 million, £70 million valuation should be available to Teck Minerals, in my view. And we're talking at, you know, a value of £22 million and 1.6p. So if you times up by three, I think that's actually really the reasonable value for Teck Minerals. That is now a revenue producing company, as we heard from Robin, and cash flow positive, and effectively de-risked, isn't it? You know, a lot of the stuff is de-risked. So,
yeah,
you know, and there are a lot of companies out there now that are undervalued because of what they're actually going to do. But we'll see. We'll see what the market actually comes to a truth, if you like, in the end, that it's us to realize that these things have much greater value than they're being given.
Okay, well, moving away from markets then, just onto something a bit more lighthearted. This is slightly related to markets, but in an entertaining way. I believe you went to see, on my recommendation, Dumb Money at the cinema. Basically, if you don't know what Dumb Money is about, it is effectively the everyday people tried to flip the script on Wall Street and get rich by turning GameStop, you all remember the GameStop fiasco from about 2-3 years ago, into one of the world's hottest companies. So in the middle of everything, there's a guy called Keith Gill, who's basically a regular guy. He starts a YouTube channel and he sinks probably most of his life savings into GameStop stock when he thinks it's at the bottom, because it's been shorted by all these hedge funds, and it all blows up, and there's effectively all the punters start buying in from the Reddit crew. So, I mean, what did you think of it? It's a very light-hearted, obviously, hedge funds fought back, and it ended in tragedy for most of them, didn't it? But what did you think?
To the moon, I like the stock.
Yeah.
I think it was a good movie. I actually thought that I felt like the end happened too quickly. They didn't expand on the information at the end, which would have been much more interesting.
Yeah.
I think
But it would have been more interesting to find out what the position, because a lot of people lost a lot of savings. Some were at hundreds of thousands up and they didn't sell. Some of them sold at the right time. It paid for the university fees. They cleared the debt.
Yeah.
You didn't really explain whether he actually made many, many millions out of it, did it, really?
No, he didn't say whether he took it, but I would imagine by the fact that the picture at the end of the movie was that he brought his brother a Ferrari, so that sort of intonated that
Porsche, not Ferrari.
He actually obviously must have taken some money off the table, otherwise he wouldn't. And actually, when I was in the cinema, I looked at the price of GameStop, the stock, and it was down to $14. Having reached like 300 and something.
Probably not far from where it was when he started. He was in the sort of like low, maybe high cents into the $1, $1, $2 area.
No, I think he started at, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it was $1, $2, $3, something like that, that he took his position. But it was interesting in the writing that pretty much right at the end, he doubled his stake when they tried to take it down after the Robin Hood thing. Had closed anybody. Yeah. He doubled his stake and then it skyrocketed to $375 within the next few weeks.
Yeah, I remember it happening live and it was literally all over the place. And that the Dave guy from Barstool Sports lost millions on it as well. He was livid. In fact, he was actually in the movie, wasn't he, being interviewed? And
yeah, that's right. So it's you know, being in the financial sector, that we all, most of you listening to this are involved, obviously, on a pretty regular basis. You should go and have a watch of it because it's a good move.
And then the other this is on Netflix, for those who've got Netflix, and it's only just been added to Netflix, but it's an old movie, 2016. It's called Gold. Matthew McConaughey plays the lead role in it. Fantastic actor, probably one of my favorite actors of all time. And it's basically loosely based on a true story of the 1993 Briex mining scandal, when a massive gold deposit was supposedly discovered in the jungles of Indonesia. So they've taken this and they've added a bit of, you know, Hollywood to it. They've called it Washoe mining to kind of like protect the people and the names of the originals who were involved. And it's just a really entertaining film where this company effectively, he's like a miner. He's original member of the company that he was owned with his dad, is McConaughey. And he meets this geologist who's like, you know, he's one of the best drillers in the world. And he basically, the drilling, they don't find any gold. I won't tell you too much, but it's fabricated. Effectively, it's all built on a bunch of lies. And it's just amazing how you can see that these companies can pull the rug over, you know, everybody from hedge funds to investors to everybody. Even the CEO wasn't in on it as well. So shocking, really, but a great watch nonetheless.
Yeah, indeed.
On that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening. If you like what you've heard, hit the subscribe and the bell icon so you get any notifications of any future episodes. And we'll look forward to updating you next week with other podcasts.
Indeed. Thanks for listening, guys, and we'll speak to you next week.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.